One pointed to a trail that went straight south. Crude letters. Philadelphia. 41 miles. The other arrow pointed straight east. New York. 38 miles.
What do they say? Annie asked.
I can get the letters, but I can't put them together so good. Yet. Samuel told her.
About the same to either place. A 3-day walk.
Let's get off the trail. I've got to think on it.
They moved back into the undergrowth and settled out of sight.
What's to think about? Annie said. We go to New York to get our ma and pa.
She did not realize what she said, but Samuel heard the hour. Something had happened in her mind. She'd found a way to stand it all, to keep going.
Samuel nodded.
What had Caleb said? Oh, yes, New York was British. But the Americans still held Philadelphia, the center of the new government. Had his mother and father come by here and seen this sign? Did they know that safety and refuge were just 40 miles away? And then did they have to go on to New York?
He shook his head.
I ought to take you into Philadelphia, where it's safe, to find a place for you.
No.
But,
no, I ain't going to leave you. You're the only family I have. It won't help to leave me someplace, 'cause I'll just run and follow you, no matter what you say. We're going to find our folks. That's all there is to it. We're going to New York.
What I was going to say,
together,
was that it would take too long to go down there and come back, 6 or 7 days, so I guess we'll stick together.
Good. That's settled.
Samuel almost smiled. She looked so ragged. Her dress was indescribably dirty, and so was her face. Her hair stuck out at odd angles. The dirt was caked on her legs, and her feet looked like shoe leather, and yet she was ready to do what had to be done. I'm proud, he thought, to have you as a sister.
All right, then, he said. Let's go.
They had a stroke of luck after they turned toward New York. Later that day, they saw a farm with fresh corn in the field. They crept into the edge of the field and took enough ears for dinner. Just after leaving the field, back in the woods alongside the trail, they heard an awful racket coming up the road from the rear. Something on wheels was clanging and clanking and rattling along. They were far enough back in the thickest part of the undergrowth so they couldn't see what it was. It stopped nearby. All was quiet, and then Samuel heard dogs panting. Before he and Annie could move, 2 black and white, mostly collie dogs came up to them in the brush, looked at them each for a moment directly into their eyes, and gently tried to push them out toward the road, using their shoulders against Samuel's and Annie's legs.
Hey, Samuel whispered, leave off.
He heard a laugh.
You might as well come out of there,
a coarse, deep voice shouted.
I know right where you are, and I've got a 2-gauge swivel gun aimed at you.
You stay here, Samuel whispered to Annie. I'll see what's going on. But no, she was not going to stay, and they both stood and walked out of the brush, the collies nudging them along. A huge freight wagon stood on the road, so stacked up with all sorts of everything, from bundles of rags to loops of tin pots tied up like garlands, to 2 saddles, to barrels and buckets, and a rocking chair, that it looked enormous. A junk pile on wheels being pulled by 2 scruffy mules.
How's your day?
The man on the wagon asked, spitting, and in such a thick Scottish brogue that it was difficult to understand him.
I'm Abner McDougall, Tinker at Large. The 2 dogs are William and Wallace, named after a Scottish hero.
He saw Samuel's rifle, and he held up his hands.
Don't shoot. I was making a jest about the swivel gun. I'm not armed,
as you can see. Don't believe in shooting things.
He seemed to be dressed in sewn-together rags and looked as untidy as the junk he was carrying. His voice had a horrible rasping sound, like a steel shovel edge hitting rocks and gravel, and he was absolutely covered in unkempt gray hair. It was almost impossible to see his face, for the hair and the lower part of his beard were soaked with tobacco stains from dribbled spit. "I'm Samuel," Samuel said. "And this is Annie." Abner nodded and looked at the dogs, which had moved in front of the mules and were peering down the trail in the direction of New York.
"Get in the back of the wagon," Abner said.
"What?"
"Get in the back of the wagon. Hide the rifle. Now. Quick. Someone wrong is coming."
"Wrong?
Move. Hide the gun."
Abner's firm voice left no room for argument. Samuel took Annie's hand and they climbed up in the back of the wagon. There was just room for them to sit with their legs out in the open wagon bed. Samuel hid his rifle and powder horn beneath a pile of cloth. He had no sooner done this than there was the sound of hooves. A troop of British cavalry dragoons came around the bend in front of the wagon and stopped. Samuel could see through the side of the wagon. There were about 20 riders in red uniforms and high fur hats and knee-high boots. They were carrying short muskets and sabers. Their horses were well-lathered, snorting and breathing hard, and the group broke formation and spread around the wagon. Two men pulled their sabers and started poking in the load from the sides until Abner said,
"Careful there. There's my bairn's bairns inside."
"Your what?" the commanding officer pulled up next to Abner.
"My grandchildren. Don't go poking them with your stickers."
"The purpose of your trip?"
"We're headed for New York. I buy things and sell things. Would you be looking for anything in particular yourself?"
"You could have any kind of illegal goods in there," the officer nodded at the wagon.
"Any kind of contraband?"
"I could, but I don't. And besides, I have a merchant's pass from the commanding general's staff, handwritten and signed and sealed, all official.
Let me see it."
Samuel heard the rustle of paper being passed back and forth. He could not see the front of the wagon, and then the officer's brusque voice.
"All right, then. Pass on. But watch for anything suspicious. We've just taken New York, and a lot of the rebel runners and deserters are trying to make their way to Philadelphia."
Samuel looked at the troopers around the back of the wagon, who were looking at him. One smiled and nodded at Annie, but she sat quietly, her eyes big and her jaw tight.
"Fall in," the officer commanded, and the men wheeled their horses into formation and rode past. "Up, Brutus! Up, Jill!"
Abner slapped the reins across the rumps of the mules, and they grunted and started pulling the wagon, which began to roll ahead slowly.
"Stay in the wagon until they're out of sight," Abner said. "Until they're gone. Then come up on the seat. We'll talk."
Samuel was confused. He decided to trust no one, and yet this old man had come forward and lied for them. He wasn't sure what to do, but some part of him wanted to trust Abner. He watched the cavalry unit disappear around a bend in the road, and then stood and climbed alongside the load until he was at the seat looking down at the backs of the mules. Annie sat down in the middle next to Abner, and Samuel took the outside.
"How did you know they were wrong?" Samuel asked.
"The dogs. They told me."
"The dogs told you?" Annie scoffed. "I didn't hear nothing."
"That's because you don't know how to listen. It's in the way they stand, how their ears sit, the hair on their back. If you know the dogs and they know you, they will tell you what to expect."
"How did you know we might think the British soldiers were bad?"
Abner slapped the reins on the mules.
"Pick it up. Pick it up. How could I think otherwise? Somebody comes down the trail and you hide in the bushes. This is largely a British road. You come out carrying a gun at the ready." He laughed. "It's hard to think you'd act that way with a friend."
"We don't like the British," Annie said suddenly. "They're all bad, Every damn one of them. They both stared at her. They killed our folks, our family, her voice cracked, and I miss them. I miss my ma and my pa. I even miss the red chicken that pecked my toes. She started crying, leaning against Samuel.
I think, Abner said, you'd better tell me what happened.
And to Samuel's complete surprise, he took a deep breath and did just that. New York City. New York was the main city where prisoners of the British troops were held. By the end of 1776, there were over 5,000 prisoners in New York, and since the population of the city was only 25,000, more than 20% of the people within city limits were captives. At that time, there was only one prison in New York. So the British held their prisoners in warehouse buildings or on Royal Navy ships anchored in the harbor. Although these ships were built to hold 350 sailors, the British kept over 1,000 prisoners at a time on board. The only latrines were buckets, which soon became full and spilled into the prisoners' sleeping quarters. Disease was rampant. At first, an average of 5 or 6 prisoners died on these ships every day. In the end, more American soldiers died in prison than in actual combat. Chapter 14. Abner sat silent for a long time after Samuel had finished telling the story of the attack and the raid, although he was less bloody in his telling than he might have been because Annie was listening. At length, Abner coughed and spit tobacco juice between the mules.
So you're thinking your folks are in New York?
It's a guess. From what I understand, Philadelphia's in American hands, and I don't think the British would take them there. Caleb heard them talking about going to New York.
And once you're in New York, you're going to find them somehow. And then with your little shooter, you're going to lope in there and shoot your way out.
Well, no. I don't know.
Right in the middle of the whole British army. You're going to sneak in and take them clean away.
When you put it that way, I guess.
I heard they had 14,000 troops for the battle to take Brooklyn Heights alone. The Continentals never had a chance. Started running before the fight started. They've probably got 20,000, 25,000 troops swarming all over that area. And you're going to jump in the middle of them. It'll be like climbing into a swarm of bees.
I don't have a plan just yet. All I know is to follow them as best I can and then work on something if I find them, when I find them.
You know what I think? Abner looked at him.
No, sir.
You don't have to call me sir.
Yes, sir. I mean, no. I don't know what you think.
I think you need help from an old coot and a couple of dogs. That's what I think.
You'd do that? Couldn't that land you into a lot of trouble? I mean, you've got that pass that lets you go places. Why would you want to help us and risk losing the pass?
Abner snorted. Ain't no pass at all. Got a friend in Philadelphia with a printing press. I had him make me a peck of forms, with a date blank and a place for somebody to sign. Official looking. I just fill in the blank with the right general's name and sign. It works every time.
That still doesn't answer the question about helping us. Samuel watched as the dogs moved to the front of the mules, one on either side, looking ahead intently, then dropped back. Somebody's coming, Annie said. She'd seen the dogs move. Shouldn't we stop?
Not soldiers, Abner said, shrugging and spitting. Just people traveling. Maybe getting out of New York. Was it soldiers? The dogs would have stayed up front, kept watching.
How do they know? Abner shook his head.
No way to know that, unless you're a dog. They kind of feel things. In the air, maybe. Or along the ground. Sometimes they put their noses down and tell it that way. But they're always right.
And they were right this time. A freight wagon was coming. Not as full as Abner's, and pulled by a team of oxen rather than mules.
There was a man walking on one side of the oxen, carrying a wooden staff, which he used to guide them, and a woman walking on the other side. On the wagon seat were two children, probably 3 and 4 years old. They passed head-on, and Samuel thought neither of them would say anything. The man just nodded at Abner. But before he was well past, Abner called.
"Dragoons ahead, patrolling the road west."
"Thank ye," the man said with a nod. "We're obliged for the knowledge, but we're going south at the turn. Head down for Philadelphia, if in it's still held."
"Held solid. Good journey," Abner said, "for you and the family. And good health."
"The same to you." And they were gone. Why don't the British soldiers come at them? Do they have a pass?
Probably not. I doubt anybody really gets a pass like mine. But the soldiers aren't always a problem. Sometimes they take things, act up rough. But other times they seem to follow some kind of rule. Unless they be Hessians.
Then even a pass might not work. He shook his head.
They ain't nothing good about the Hessians. They were born bad.
Annie nodded. She had been so quiet Samuel had almost forgotten she was there sitting between them. Her voice was brittle, like it could break in the middle of a word. "They're all bad." It will be years, Samuel thought, before she can forget. Maybe her whole life. And I don't blame her. I feel the same, and I didn't see my parents bayoneted. The thought of his parents brought back the memory of the question he had asked Abner, which had not been answered. "We never heard why you want to help us," he said. "Couldn't it make trouble for you?"
"No more than I make for myself."
"Still."
"You're pushing at this, ain't you?"
Abner smiled, though in the hair and spit stains it was hard to tell. "Kind of like a root hog digging at it." "I want to know. It doesn't make sense. You don't know anything about us, but you'd risk trouble to help us? You've got to admit it seems strange. I mean, I'm grateful, mighty grateful, but..."
"Well, thinking on it, there's two reasons."
"We're listening."
"First, when you get old and start to smell an end to things, your brain starts doing things on its own, whether you like it or not. You might be looking at a piece of meat cooking on a fire, hungry and ready to eat, or sitting up here alone, watching the mules pull on a lazy, sunny afternoon. And your brain starts in adding and subtracting, measuring your life."
"What do you mean?" Annie looked up at him.
"Well, it says you've done this many things wrong, and this many things right, like a ledger with lines down the middle. Maybe you helped somebody load a wagon once, and that would go on the good side. And then maybe you ate a piece of pie somebody else wanted, somebody else deserved, and that would go on the bad side."
"Well, we all do that, don't we?" Samuel asked. "Think about things, and then try to do the right one?"
"We can hope so. But until you get old, you don't really start adding them up. When you're young, you forget some of the things, both good and bad. But when you get old, it's amazing how much you remember. I keep pulling up parts of my life from when I was barely off the milk, bawling after my mum in Scotland. I stole a tiny piece of bread I wasn't supposed to eat on the ship on the way over here. And that's in there, waiting to be added in, even though I puked it up not 2 minutes after I ate it." He snorted and spit, this time almost to the noses of the mules. "I wasn't one for sailing. The boat rocked once, the first time I got on it. And I was sick all the way across."
He stopped the wagon because they met some young men on foot, obviously fleeing. There were 3 of them, and one had bandages around his upper left arm. They waved but kept moving west along the trail at a trot. Abner warned the men about the cavalry, and they nodded. Samuel thought they should be moving off the side of the trail into the brush, but didn't say anything. They probably knew more than he did, since they'd been fighting. He was very glad that he and Annie had run into Abner, but knew that if they hadn't, they would have traveled as much as possible in the thick brush. In the woods was life. Out here, in the open.
"You said two," Samuel said, watching the men until they were out of sight. "If the cavalry were coming back, they would be caught, probably killed."
It all seemed so crazy. Men walking down a road, somebody coming along and killing them.
"Two reasons to help us. What's the other one?"
"Well, the first one was almost all rubbish. I mean, it's true, but maybe a little too flowery to be real. I like the way it sounds, though. Almost like it might be written somewhere." Abner chuckled. "Being alone most of the time, I don't get much of a chance to flower things up. Maybe I should write it down. Somebody might read it sometime and think I was more than I really am."
Lord, Samuel thought, for somebody who spends most of his time alone, he sure does like to hear his own voice. He waited.
"But the second is quick. The truth is that I'm too old to fight."
Abner laughed. Annie jumped, and Samuel realized she'd been dozing.
"I like a good scrap, and I'm too old for this one. So I go back and forth with news. Try to help."
"You're a spy."
"No, no, that's too hard a word. Though I expect these redcoats would hang me proper if they knew. I go back and forth with news about things that are happening that some might be interested in hearing about. I sell a little, buy a little, and carry a word now and then. And I help them that needs it when I can. I can't really fight, my bones would break. But if I help those who are against the redcoats, it's right close to fighting. I can't stand the redcoats, and you don't like them either. Is that good enough for you?"
Samuel nodded, watching the dogs move up the trail and back again.
"That's good enough for me, and thank you for the help."
Covert communication. Both the American and the British military forces disguised their communication so that messages could not be easily read if captured by their enemies. Prearranged letters or words replaced other letters or words, all of which had to be memorized by huge numbers of different people. But the secret codes were frequently and easily broken. Mathematical codes were experimented with, but the complexity limited their effectiveness, especially given the length of time it took to pass messages from one party to another. Invisible inks that could be made visible with heat or a series of chemicals, as well as messages hidden in common publications such as pamphlets and almanacs, were common ways to ensure the security of sensitive information. Chapter 15. They were still several days away from the city of New York, and an almost constant stream of refugees came at them. Some had obviously been soldiers or fighting men of one kind or another. There were many with wounds wrapped in crude bandages. Abner stopped the wagon and furnished bandages for those who didn't have them. He also had a supply of laudanum, a painkiller that was half opium and half alcohol, and he gave some of the more gravely wounded a small bottle.
"Take it sparingly," he said in a deep voice. "Best at night, before sleeping."
To everyone he said,
"Stay off the roads. Redcoats are about."
Cart after wagon after cart passed them, being pulled by mules or oxen. A goodly number of the people were soldiers, but the vast majority were civilians, often whole families.
"Where do you suppose they're all going?" Samuel thought of the devastation on the trail to his rear. It certainly didn't seem like a safe place. Hessians, soldiers, savages. "Down to Philadelphia?"
Abner nodded.
At times, travelers were so thick, Abner had trouble moving the wagon through.
"Are they running from the redcoats?" This from Annie, who teared up when she saw a little girl trudging along and holding a doll by one arm.
"That and more,"
Abner said. Not just the soldiers. Like I said, some of them aren't that bad. I mean, a while ago we were all loyal Englishmen. It's more what redcoats signify. The English crown has become a way of life these people no longer want. Part is they're scared, don't know what will happen. But along with that, these people are sick of being told what to do by a crazy king, who lives 3,000 miles away and doesn't care about them one way or the other.
What do you mean, crazy? Samuel asked.
King George, Abner said. They say he's touched. Crazy as a bag of hazelnuts. They've got people to catch him when he runs wild, put his clothes on when he tears them off, watch him when he sleeps so he doesn't kill himself. He's no man to run a kingdom.
Did he start the war?
It seemed a logical question. The war was so crazy, maybe a crazy man started it. Probably not. It began on this side of the ocean in Boston, not over there. People were sick of being treated like livestock. The dogs had been going ahead now and then to greet some people, their tails wagging, holding back with others, but now they dropped well back and Abner stopped the wagon. British coming! If he hadn't seen the dogs, he would have known anyway. All the men who looked like patriot soldiers evaporated off the trail into the brush. The soldiers came marching in a file. Not Hessians, but regular British soldiers. There must have been 200 or 300 of them, as near as Samuel could estimate, marching in loose route step, followed by supply wagons. They did nothing threatening. They didn't stop at all, except to work around wagons that couldn't get out of the way soon enough. Abner watched them go by in silence, nodding at some of them. And when they were gone, he started up the mules. It was late in the day, and he said, "Why don't we stop for a good meal tonight?" They had been eating corn and the venison, which was about gone. Samuel had been thinking he should take his rifle and head off into the woods for another deer tomorrow.
"What do you mean?"
"I mean have somebody cook us a meal. Say, the people in that farm over there."
He pointed to a farm set well back off the road, with neat white fences and a white-painted house.
"Right there."
Samuel and Annie said nothing. The house reminded Samuel of Annie's home before the Hessians, and he wondered if she felt the same. As they had gotten closer to the city, there had been more and more cleared farms. Some were nice, even beautiful. Some had been attacked and burned, probably by the Hessians, but many had not. It made no sense, nor did it follow any logic, like so much of what had happened. Abner pulled the wagon into the long drive, and then the yard. There was a wooden watering trough by a hand pump, and the mules went to it and started drinking. Abner, Samuel, and Annie climbed down from the wagon.
"Let them drink," Abner said. "Mules don't blow themselves by overdrinking the way horses do."
There was a barn, painted red as Caleb's had been. Samuel sneaked a look at Annie, but she seemed to take it in stride. A man came from the barn. He was tall, thin, and had a tired felt hat, which he pushed to the back of his head. He started to say something, but before he could get anything out, Abner held up his hand.
"Name's Abner MacDougall. Honor to the house, and we come in peace. I have a fine surface sharpening stone wheel, and I repair and sharpen all tools in the house and barn. All work for one good meal for me and the bairns.
Well, also buy and sell rags. Have some nice linen rags if the lady of the house needs some soft garment material."
He spoke fast, never letting the man get a word in.
"If you don't need anything we've got, we'll just thank you for the water for the mules and be on our way."
The man removed his hat and rubbed his head.
"Well, I've got some sickle bars that could use a honing, and I expect Martha has some knives that need touching up."
"No sooner said than done. Sam, why don't you get that sharpening wheel down and we'll get to edging things up."
Samuel,
who had never been called Sam in his life, went to the back of the wagon and peered into the mess. He hadn't really looked at it before, but now, as he pulled some things aside, he found a sharpening wheel, a wooden frame with a treadle and a small tin cup to drip water on the stone. When he pulled it out of the way, he found a wire-covered crate pushed under some things. It had some kind of birds in it, and on closer examination he saw they were pigeons, live pigeons. How strange. He hadn't even known they were there. Why were they hidden? He took the wheel down and put it by the trough, filled the tin cup and hung it by the wire over the wheel so water would drip from a small hole in the can onto the stone. He made sure the treadle worked and the wheel spun. The man came from the barn with three hand sickles that had the long curved blade used for harvesting wheat or other grains. Abner took one, stood by the wheel, and gestured to Samuel to start pumping with his leg to get the stone spinning. Abner held the first blade against the stone as it turned, making a scraping, hissing sound, and the steel edge ground down to razor sharpness. Samuel was amazed at how easily the stone spun. This shouldn't take too long. How peaceful it all seemed. He kept pumping until the sickle was done. Then another, and Samuel switched pumping legs. Legs a little tired. And another, he switched legs again. Legs a little more tired. Then three axes, two picks, a tomahawk, a set of rail-splitting wedges, six of them, four slaughtering and sticking knives, and four butcher knives that Martha, a short, thin woman who was all smiles, brought from the house. Then an ice chisel, two serrated hay knives, two planking adzes, one shingle fro, and at last an old cavalry saber that the farmer named Micah used for chopping corn. Samuel staggered over to the trough to wash. Abner put his whole head under water and then shook like a dog. He pulled his hair back and combed his beard down, and Samuel saw Micah smile at him. He saw something else there. A look of what? Recognition? As if they already knew each other? The meal was good, very good, though not up to what they had eaten at Caleb's. Venison stew, piles of new potatoes, fresh bread with new butter, apple pie made with maple sugar, and fresh buttermilk cool from the spring house on the side of the barn, in quantities to fill even Samuel. He was shy about asking for seconds, but Martha kept piling it on, and he ate it gratefully. Sit-down meals were always rare in his life, even before the war. He winced at that thought. Before the war. There didn't seem to be such a thing anymore. What with his living in the woods on the hunt most of the time. But being a guest was almost unheard of, and he wasn't sure how to act. He needn't have worried. As with Caleb and Ma, Micah and Martha made eating enjoyable, not something to fret over. When they were done with seconds and thirds on the pie, even Annie ate like a wolf. They went out to sit on the porch while Micah and Abner lit up clay pipes with coals from the fireplace. "The food gets better every time I stop here," Abner said, ending the mystery. "I didn't think it was possible." "She can cook," Micah nodded, smiling. "In fact, there ain't much she can't do." Annie and Samuel sat on the edge of the porch. The dogs were in the dirt in front of them. Annie was about to doze off, but Samuel wanted to listen, so he sat drawing pictures in the dirt with a stick, the dogs watching with a kind of casual interest as the stick moved around. "Know anything about the happenings in New York?" Abner asked. "How it went?" Micah shook his head. "Not much. The English took it and a bunch of prisoners. They moved in, the English. Took over houses for their own. They ain't making a lot of friends. Of course, that doesn't seem to bother them much, not making friends. The way they brought those damn Hessians into it, hiring mad dogs.
The passes I brought you working out?
So far. I'm more worried about scavengers hitting us. The wild ones would kill you for a turnip, but we're still here, ain't we?
Good. I've got some more birds to leave. You still have that hutch in back of the barn?
Yes.
Same as before? Send one if anything big comes along. I'll send one this evening. We saw a large detachment heading up the road today. Maybe 200. They ought to know about it back in Philadelphia.
If the Hawks don't get 'em. I don't know how any of them get past the Hawks.
Well, there's always that. Always some risk. But it's better than nothing.
The pigeons are for carrying messages, Samuel thought. He glanced at Abner out of the corner of his eye. There was so much more to him than he'd thought at first. The men sat smoking in silence for a moment. Then Abner said,
"You said they took some prisoners. Sam's parents weren't military, but they took them prisoners anyway."
"They're doing that," Micah nodded. "No sense to it. Just see a man working in a field and take him prisoner. Stupid. Like they think the crops are going to plant themselves."
"You know where they're keeping the prisoners?"
"Not certain. There are warehouses and an old sugar mill. You remember that three-story thing they built to mill sugar?" Abner nodded.
"Along the waterfront?"
"Yes. I think they might use that. Along with the warehouses, there are thousands of prisoners. I don't know how they'll feed them. Plus, I suppose plenty of them were wounded. It can't be good for them."
"Well," Abner said,
knocking his pipe out on the side of the porch.
This, Samuel saw, made the dogs stand up and get ready. He was amazed by them. They saw everything. "We'll see what we can see," Abner said.
It was starting to get dark.
"You mind if we sleep here tonight? We'll be out of here early."
"Why would I mind? There's new hay in the loft. Makes a good bed, long as you don't smoke." And with the mules unharnessed, fed hay and put out in a pen for the night, Abner took time to put two pigeons in the hutch in back of the barn. He wrote something on a tiny piece of thin paper, tied it to a third pigeon's leg, and let him go. He and Samuel and Annie watched the bird fly away to the south.
"He'll roost somewhere tonight if he doesn't get there before dark. It's probably only 40 miles in a straight flight. An hour the way they move. So he should make it. Imagine, moving through the air at 40 miles an hour. Just imagine."
Later, lying on the new hay with the clover smell thick around him, Samuel could hear Annie breathing regularly in sleep. He teetered on the edge of it, but before it came he said to Abner, who was lying just above him on the stacked hay bales, "You and Micah aren't what you seem to be. Are you?"
"We are," Abner chuckled. "Exactly what we seem to be. And maybe just a little bit more."
Civilian intelligence. Individuals and civilian spy networks carried out the most vital American intelligence operations of the Revolutionary War. Men and women whose daily lives and work brought them into proximity with the British military, such as farmers and merchants, fed important information to the American authorities throughout the war. Some patriots even posed as loyalists to infiltrate pro-British groups, collecting detailed facts about British military operations and defenses, supply lines, and battle plans. Chapter 16. There was a long, shallow hill as they came into what Samuel would have called a city, and Abner stopped the mules at the top of it, still half a mile out, and studied it. Samuel had never imagined such a place. Houses and other buildings everywhere, built on the land next to the open water. And that water was another thing he'd never seen. "Is that it?" he asked. "That water? Is that part of the ocean?"
"That's the Hudson River," Abner sighed,
as they moved from settlement to settlement,
each one bigger than the last, Samuel and Annie had been asking, "Is this New York?"
"And that's not New York either," Abner said. "Not yet. We're in New Jersey. Look there, across the river, through the fog. That's New York. We'll leave the wagon here and the mules and get a boat across. I know somebody who might help us."
Down below, on mud flats that led out to the river, Samuel saw dozens of boats pulled up to the shoreline, some large, some small, and men waiting to row them across the river. Now and then, through the mist, he could make out what seemed to be a large city. Large? Huge.
"Wait here," Abner said. "I'm going to go look for a friend."
Between the wagon and the river were many buildings, some with fenced-in pens full of oxen and horses and mules. Abner came back.
"Very well."
With him was a man who looked a lot like him, gray hair everywhere, tobacco spit down his chin, old clothes.
"Matthew here is going to take us across and bring us back. We have had enterprise with each other before, and he understands the nature of our business. I told him we hope it won't take long, and that we prefer coming back in the dark, if possible, and fast. We'll leave the wagon and mules and dogs with his boys on this side. They'll keep them ready for us. Samuel, you may take your knife, but leave your rifle here. There are soldiers everywhere, and a rifle will draw attention. Annie, you wait here with the wagon."
"No."
"Yes."
"He is all I've got."
"And he will be back. If this works right, there'll be two more people coming back with us. And the boat is not that big. We might need the room."
She looked at Samuel. "You come back."
"I will."
"I'm telling you, you better. Or else."
Samuel could see that she was crying, and he found himself choking up but hid it.
"Don't worry." He put his hand on her shoulder.
The truth was, he had no idea about anything. They didn't even know for certain if his parents were over there. He looked across the river. It was late afternoon, and the sun was burning the fog off. The city was huge, with buildings standing 3 and 4 stories high, and houses spread out in a grid.
How could they hope to find anybody in all those buildings? Looking at the city, imagining how many people must be there, made the rest of the trip seem almost easy. The woods, the forest, was nothing compared to this.
"Away," Matthew croaked. "We must go. Darkness comes fast on the river, and we must be across when there is still light for to see. Follow?"
Abner moved with him toward the boats, and after a moment's hesitation, Samuel followed. There were about 100 boats pulled up along the mud bank in a long line, tied to brush or small trees. And most of them looked to be on their last legs, water-soaked, unpainted clunkers, covered with mud and filth that came down the river. Samuel was surprised, considering that Matthew looked even rougher than Abner, to find that he brought them to a beautifully maintained, painted, double-ended boat about 20 feet long. There was a small cabin in the center and a short mast up over the cabin. The cabin itself could only take 2 people. Matthew said, "Get inside. What isn't seen isn't noted." He grunted as he heaved the boat out of the mud and into the slow current. Then he jumped in, pulled the sail up, the canvas surprisingly clean and well-tended, and stood to the tiller. There were no seats or benches except in the cabin, but a wooden bailing bucket was in the stern. As soon as the boat was moving in the soft breeze, Matthew pulled the bucket over and sat, put a chew of tobacco in the corner of his cheek, smiled through discolored teeth at Samuel, and said, "Your ma and pa know you're coming to get 'em?" Samuel looked sharply at Abner. He must have told Matthew the whole story. Abner smiled.
"We have done a mite of business together. I told him what we were doing. You can trust him with your life, which," he snorted,
is exactly what you're doing.
Abner has a whole network, Samuel thought, to work against the British. People on farms, pigeons, and now the man with this boat. Abner was the most amazing man Samuel had ever met.
No, Samuel said. They probably think I'm dead, killed by the Indians.
Matthew nodded. A fair surprise for them, then. It's good to have surprises for your family.
And he tended to sailing the boat and didn't say another word all the way across the river. It was just as well, because with the lack of anything productive to think about, Samuel didn't know where they were going, wasn't sure what he would find, and didn't know what he would do when he found or didn't find his parents. His mind was taken up by the sailing. The boat must have been fairly heavy, yet it skimmed along over the water like a leaf. It wasn't so terribly fast, maybe 3 or 4 miles an hour, but it seemed graceful in some way. No, that wasn't it. Free. The wind moved them along quietly, and nobody worked to make it so. It just happened. The boat nudged into the bank. Out, Matthew said, and up the bank. The road into town is on the left, sugar mill down to the right 1/4 mile. I'll come back every night at midnight and wait until 3 in the morning for 4 nights. If you're not here by then, I'll figure the worst. What do you want done with the girl if you get scragged?
Can you take her? Abner paused. Into your family.
Matthew hesitated.
Well, he said, Emily always wanted a daughter. So be it. But we'll bet against it. And he pushed the boat back into the current and was gone.
Abner said, Let's get to it. And he moved up the bank with Samuel following. At the top, Samuel stopped dead. There were people everywhere, all along the road into the city and down the side road that led to the sugar mill, maybe hundreds of them. And it seemed that almost every man was wearing a red coat. Soldiers were wherever you looked, armed and walking next to the buildings, roughly forcing civilians to move out into the street.
"Let's start down toward the mill," Abner said. "There might be somebody we can talk to, get a mite of information."
They hadn't gone 20 yards when 2 soldiers, rifles fixed with bayonets, stopped them.
"State your business," one said.
"I'm on the Crown's business," Abner answered, "from across the river. Looking to bring food to the prisoners. I was told they're in the old sugar mill. Is that so?"
The soldiers laughed.
"Aye," said one. "There and in warehouses and churches. But don't waste food on the rebels. You might as well feed it to the hogs, for all the good it will do. They're all marked for the box."
They went off laughing, and Abner started walking again, heading for the sugar mill, Samuel following. What had the soldiers meant by marked for the box? He was so engrossed in his thoughts and in keeping up with Abner, who could walk surprisingly fast, that he almost ran full on into his mother. His mother, right in front of him. It was a thing that could not happen, impossible. For the first moment, neither of them believed it. She was dumping out a bucket of slops in the gutter as he was dashing down the street after Abner. She glanced up at him and then back at the pail just as he dodged out of her way, hurrying to keep up with Abner. In that instant, though, their heads jerked back to face each other, and they stood stunned. The world around them stopped.
Samuel?
She dropped the bucket to the ground, reaching out her hand, cracked and red and worn, to gently touch his cheek.
"Are you? We thought you were. After the attack, is it really you?"
Samuel couldn't breathe, couldn't speak.
"We...
And then they were holding each other, both crying, until Abner said,
Leave off. Damn it, leave off. People are watching. Back away.
They moved away from each other. She was very thin and drawn and looked so small, Samuel thought.
Father, is he...
Down the road, in that big building, an old sugar mill full of men, prisoners. I work in this house, she pointed, cleaning. I get a corner to sleep in and leftover and scrap food, which I take to your father each night. I'm a prisoner, too, but this family treats me fairly. She stopped. What happened to your head? It's nothing. It's scarred.
Tell us about the prisoners, Abner cut in. Everything you know.
She looked at Abner, then at Samuel. He's helping me, Samuel said. Tell him everything.
Helping you what?
We don't have time now, Mother. Tell him what he asks. Samuel worried they'd be caught talking and she'd have to go in. Please. The prisoners are barely fed. Your father can hardly stand or walk.
Guards, Abner said. How many guards?
There are guards inside with the prisoners. At the door, two. But one sleeps almost all the time. The other is by the main door. The back door is nailed and boarded shut. There's only one way out. If there was a fire...
Can you get a private message to your husband today or early tonight?
She nodded. When I bring the food, the guard goes through it and takes anything good. It's such a small amount, you'd think he'd just let it be. But I will find a way to hide a message.
Tell him to be at the front door at midnight. At the middle of the night, if he hasn't a watch. And tell him to be there, hiding close by the guard, alone. Just him. Understand?
Yes.
Can you slip out at midnight?
Abner was abrupt, terse.
Right here, at midnight.
I will. There are a lot of drunken soldiers on the street at night, but yes.
All right, do that. Tell your husband to get by the door at midnight alone. You'll be out here at midnight, or just a few minutes after.
She nodded, looking from Abner to Samuel.
We'll come for you then, if everything works right. Now say your goodbyes and get back in the house before we get discovered.
Samuel, she said, turning toward him, you're sure you're all right? Everything will be right after tonight, Mother. Please, please be careful. I thought you were dead, and I just got you back. I can't lose you again.
Go inside, he whispered.
He almost smiled. Telling him to be careful now, after all that had happened, that horse was well and truly gone from the barn. We'll be back later. They looked at each other. She smiled, her lips trembling, staring at him as if to memorize his face. Then, at last, she picked up the slop bucket and went back into the house.
Prisoners of the British. During the war, at least 16 British hulks, ships that had been damaged and abandoned, lay in the waters off the shores of New York City as floating prisons. Over 10,000 prisoners died of intentional neglect, starvation, and untreated disease. Their bodies were tossed overboard into the harbor or buried in shallow graves at the shoreline by fellow prisoners. Chapter 17.
Darkness. Like the inside of a dead cow. There had been a sliver of a moon, but clouds covered it, and with them came a soft rain, enough to make everything wet and uncomfortable outside, a godsend. Even drunken soldiers didn't like to be out in the rain. Abner and Samuel had gone by the sugar mill just before dark to look it over. Samuel's mother had been right. Only one door was being used, and two guards stood there talking. One had a chair. There was a small roof over the entry to keep the rain off. The building was strangely quiet. If there are hundreds of men packed inside, Samuel thought, there should be more noise.
They walked past the guards, who paid them no mind, and down alongside the building. Now and then they could hear scuffling and thumping against the wall on the inside, but nothing else. When they had walked completely past the building, they crossed the street and came back on the other side. Because of the rain, there weren't many soldiers along the walkways, and no one bothered them. They went along the river to a point close to where Matthew would come across, and then moved into some trees along the bank. It was starting to get dark. Abner pulled a small oil-soaked bag from the inside of his coat and took out a watch. 7:30. He put the watch back, settled down against a tree, hunched up the collar of his coat. Try to get a little sleep, 'cause later tonight there won't be any. How are we going to do it? Samuel asked. Get him out.
Simple plans are best, Abner said. Did you see all the bricks around the steps? They probably had more of a porch when the place was new. Now the bricks have all fallen down. I'll distract a guard. You take a brick and hit him over the head.
That's your plan? Samuel stared at him. What if both guards are there? Abner said.
I'll be ready for him. You just do your part.
Samuel still stared. We've come this far, and you tell me just to hit him over the head with a brick?
Hard, Abner added. Hit him over the head hard. Then we open the door, grab your father and run like hell, or as fast as we can go. Scoop up your mother, get in the boat, get across the Hudson, hook up the mules, get in the wagon and head out. A good, simple plan.
In the end, that was exactly the way it worked. Almost. Samuel surprised himself. After an hour of his thoughts tumbling over each other without sense or reason, in spite of the rain, a veil slipped over his mind, and he slept, leaning against the same tree as Abner.
"Let's get to it,"
Abner shook him awake close to midnight. Samuel rubbed his face and stood. Abner was gone in the darkness, and Samuel had to hurry to catch up. Their path took them past the house where Samuel's mother worked. She was already outside and saw them approach.
"I'm coming with you," she said, softly as they neared, "to help."
"No, hold. Hold here. We'll be back," Abner whispered. "Shortly."
As they walked closer to the sugar mill, Abner took off his coat and wrapped it so that it seemed he was carrying a bundle. There was a tiny glow from a lantern near the guard, the kind with a small candle inside and a slit to let out a sliver of light. It was enough for Samuel to see some bricks. He picked one up before they moved within range of the guard.
"Halt," the guard said as he saw them.
Samuel held the brick behind him.
"State your purpose."
"Bringing food," Abner said, holding up the bundle.
"For the prisoners."
"Advance." The guard stepped forward, interested in the package. They climbed the steps to the entrance, Abner in front of the guard and Samuel slightly to the side, gripping the brick. Abner held the bundle out. The guard put the butt of his musket on the ground to free one hand to open the package. He leaned forward, and Abner said in a soft, conversational tone,
"Now, Samuel."
And Samuel hit the guard with the brick. Hard. A moment's hesitation, then the guard fell. Abner caught him, slid him off the side of the door, laid him on the platform, turned to the door.
"Padlocked," he swore.
Gently, delicately, he worked the keys off the guard's belt and unlocked the door. He flung it open. Samuel's father was in the doorway, and even in the dim glow, Samuel could see that he was in bad shape. Face skull-like, eyes sunken. He almost fell into Samuel's arms. But he wasn't alone. 30, 40 men were waiting with him, and as soon as he was outside, they piled out, scattering like quail, a stream of prisoners, thin as cadavers, pouring out of the shed in a strange silence, moving off in all directions.
"Come," Abner took Samuel's father's arm. "No time."
With Abner on one side and Samuel on the other,
They carried Samuel's father, toes dragging through the darkness. Samuel's mother was waiting and hurried over to help. Twice they tripped and stumbled in the darkness. But they were up fast and moved as rapidly as possible to where Matthew would be with the boat. He wasn't there.